Okay.
Okay.
So, who are you?
So, my name is Giles Thomas. I'm the Managing Director and CTO of a British software company called Resolver Systems.
Resolver Systems.
Yes.
So, what does Resolver Systems do?
Well, we've actually just released, just 2 weeks ago, the first version of our first product. It's called Resolver One, which is not a hugely inventive name, but the one is meant to signify that it unifies two different ideas. Almost the concept of a spreadsheet and of a programming language.
Okay, so you've got a demo for us. We've been
Absolutely.
Hearing a lot of good things about Resolver at lang.net, because you've been at lang.net.
Yes, I have, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, all right. Well,
so you want to cut to demo, and then we can start.
Talk more,
so. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
See it in action.
Here it is. So this is Resolver 1 running on this laptop here. As I said, it unifies two ideas, so that's the concept of a spreadsheet and a programming language.
Mm-hmm.
And as you'd expect in doing that, it looks like a mixture of the two. So at the top here, let me just move this sash to the middle of the window. At the top, you can see we've got a grid, which is just like you'd expect in a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
And down here, we've got a programming pane, a code pane, which literally holds a program which is identical to the contents of the grid. It's mostly folded up here, so let me just open it up a little bit so you can see that, and that might make it clearer. So you see, at the top here we have a spreadsheet which is a workbook with three worksheets.
Okay.
And down here there is the code which has got a workbook object, and it's adding sheet 1, sheet 2, sheet 3.
And this is Excel, or this is an Excel-like experience?
It's an Excel-like experience.
Okay.
So... You can see down here we have code which expresses the constants and the formatting inside the worksheet. And
okay.
I
don't see any.
You don't see any, exactly, because it's an empty worksheet right now. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do is I'll start adding some data into this workbook. So if I add item, let's say it's a price list, so I'll have item and price. You see in real time the code is updating.
So just real quick, we added top cells here, mm-hmm. and then... You see it actually being code-gen in real time.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So in real time, you're getting a program which is which represents an identical model to the one you're building in the grid at the top.
Okay.
So let's put a bit more data into here. Let's just say we've got items A, B, and C. And we've got prices 23, 24, 25. And as I entered them, you just see all of the code being written.
Okay.
So okay.
Let's check out that code real quick. So let's talk about this code real quick.
Mm-hmm.
What language is this?
This code is all written in the Iron Python programming language.
Iron Python?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we chose Iron Python for a number of reasons. And actually, if I add a formula, it'll make it really clear what the biggest advantage of using Iron Python versus, for example, C#
sure.
might be. So if I scroll down the code a little bit so we can see what's changing, the constants are held in one block here and the formulae down there. So I'm just going to enter a formula up here. I'll just say the sum of the three values I've already entered. And down at the bottom, you can see we've got some Iron Python code which expresses that formula. So workbook sheet1.b5 equals the sum of a cell range, which is
okay.
exactly what we entered. Now, why is Iron Python such a good language for this? Well, firstly, it's very clear and very easy to understand. But also, this little bit of syntax here, .b5,
mm-hmm.
if we were using a static language such as C#, then we'd have to have special get cell at this position functions and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you're using a dynamic language like Python, then your objects can all have an arbitrary number of attributes with patterns as their names almost.
Mm-hmm.
So on this worksheet object, we have an infinite number of properties, each of which is named after a cell.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that just real quick. So is that duck typing? Is that, or how are you actually doing the type lookup there?
The the type is fixed. The type is just a worksheet object. But in Iron Python, you can define a method called getAttra.
Okay.
It's a double underscore getAttra, double underscore, slightly ugly syntax. But what it means is that an object of a class that defines getAttra can specify out how it handles the lookup on unknown properties.
Okay.
So our worksheet class says, okay, I don't recognize this particular property. However, it matches a particular regular expression, so letter, 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 digit, digit.
Mm-hmm.
And it does the lookup and works out that's actually cell C15.
Okay.
And then just looks up in the internal dictionary, which is how it represents the objects that are inside the grid.
Okay. Now, is that just talking about the dynamism mm-hmm. of languages? Are there things that are unique to Iron Python within that, or could you use another dynamic language like either Perl or Lua? I think has some similar constructs like that, or something in between, or is there something that's unique to Iron Python in particular?
I don't think there's anything particularly unique to Iron Python. This is something you get out of pretty much all dynamic languages,
right?
As far as I'm aware. I don't know Lua.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure with Perl and with Ruby you'd be fine.
Okay.
The other reason we like Python is because it is particularly user-friendly to non-technical people.
Okay.
I know that there's kind of a cult attitude towards significant white space. People either love it or they hate it.
Right.
But for non-programmers, people who aren't used to the curly bracket syntax or begins and ends, it is actually quite natural. If you look at how somebody writes pseudocode when they're plotting out an algorithm, they'll usually use indentation and they'll make it significant. And that holds even for programmers. So for non-programmers, significant white space, I think, actually helps.
Yeah, so one of the things that maybe people watching the video aren't familiar with Python as a language, mm-hmm. Python, what you mean by significant white space is if I actually indent something, it then, say, becomes a member of that class, if you will, or mm-hmm. my for loop, for example, indentation takes on an entire new meaning. Like, it's not just for printing your code, it actually changes what that code means.
That's exactly, yes. I mean, maybe it would help if I wrote a bit of code
let's
here as well.
Do it.
Let's show some Python code live. So, what I've showed you so far is entering stuff in a grid and generating code, which is, you know, kind of fun, but not necessarily immediately valuable. What I will do is enter a bit of code down at the bottom here. Before I do that, I'm just going to do one little resolver trick and say that the first row of this spreadsheet is a header row. This just allows me to say I want the price in a row rather than saying column B.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just write some code with significant white space. So I will say for the row in the workbook sheet 1 dot rows, if the row's price is less than 25, row dot back color equals my favorite .NET color, peach buff. Okay, so I've written a bit of code and...
So now when you hit enter, you're actually evaluating that statement right there. There is no, say, compile.
Exactly. Well, it's not quite when you hit enter, it's when you click out of the code box.
Oh, okay.
So we don't want you running halfway through when you've just defined the for part of your loop.
Okay.
But the interesting thing with Python and the significant white space is if you look at this particular pattern of code here, the fact that the if is nested inside the for is implicit in the fact that it's indented immediately mm-hmm. afterwards, and the fact that this statement here is conditional on the if is again represented by its indentation.
Right, so instead of the begin-end in sort of the VB languages and curly brackets mm-hmm. to note indentation, it's actually those tabs there.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So that's Python. That's a simple
okay.
example of showing code that's manipulating the grid as well.
Okay, so why would somebody be interested in using Resolver versus, say, a regular VBA solution? And who is this really targeted at? Is this for specific, say, verticals like finance, where somebody would need to do some sort of these functions, or is it for the power user of Excel, or who's the right audience here?
It's really the power users of Excel, and they do cluster in specific verticals. Most of the power users of Excel are going to be in the financial industry. There mm-hmm. are probably some in other industries, such as the life sciences as well, where people are dealing with lots of numbers. But finance is pretty much where the bulk of them are.
Okay.
And the reason we think it's a useful solution for them, above and beyond using VBA, is when you're dealing with spreadsheets that pass a certain level of complexity. So really complex spreadsheets, but also complex spreadsheets that are going to last for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Things tend to go wrong, and we view that as being because A spreadsheet is a computer program fundamentally, and the spreadsheet applications like Excel are a great way of hiding that from users who don't need to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many users there are of Excel worldwide. I've heard figures up in the hundreds of millions. Let's say there's 100 million. 99 million people don't care that they're writing a program when they write their spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
But the 1 million who do get bitten by this because the abstraction that Excel and OpenOffice and all the other spreadsheets are providing that hides the program nature of their spreadsheets from them
mm-hmm.
starts leaking when you get to pass a certain level of complexity.
Okay.
The spreadsheet starts doing things which they don't expect it to do. And that is because the spreadsheet is acting like a computer program, but they're seeing it through a abstracted layer. So what we wanted to do with Resolver Systems as a company, is build tools that allow those power users, the ones who are getting hurt by the abstraction, to see through the abstraction, actually see the computer program that underlies the spreadsheets that they're used to building.
Okay.
And then this helps them because right now, either they're spreadsheet programmers and they build stuff and it goes wrong and they don't know why and they get confused and frustrated and they bring in their IT guys to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternatively, they start trying to learn Visual Studio and those tools themselves. And they're great tools if you're a full-time tech person. But if you're a financial specialist, then you don't necessarily want to learn all of the details of source code control and all the things that we as tech people know are vital to serious technology projects.
So where do you see, like, the power user might be familiar with VBA, or what do you see the advantages, disadvantages, or possibly another way to put it would be, like, when to use which Resolver versus, say, just going into VBA?
I would say that for complex spreadsheets, if they're short-lived, then it's not a problem. If it's something that's going to last for a couple of days, something to really capture the phrase I've heard is an ephemeral business opportunity. So if something very short-lived, they've got to put something together very quickly and then throw it away, then a tool like using VBA is a good way to solve that. Similarly, if they've got something that's very simple and regular in structure, and that's going to last for a long time, that's going to work too.
Mm-hmm.
Because the simple, regular structure will always save you. The pattern doesn't change, and so the complexity doesn't break things down too badly.
Okay.
It's when stuff is both complex and long-lived that you need to start moving to onto something more.
That's
powerful.
When you hit sort of like the ceiling, if you will.
Exactly.
With VBA.
Exactly, and you don't necessarily want to go straight over to something powerful like C#, largely because people don't want to necessarily spend the time to learn the language, but also because it's not necessarily the right tool for the job.
Okay, and talking in some of the things that we've seen coming out of the office is the ability to connect to either remote data, report on remote data, doing business intelligence from back-end systems. Mm-hmm. Are there things or libraries or functionality you've built to say, you know, contact our financial system mm-hmm. and then run these, probabilities or whatever the function happens to be?
Absolutely. Because in Resolver 1 you've got a program which represents your spreadsheet.
Sure.
You can do anything in the program and on the grid that you could do inside a program. So let's say, in fact I have a demonstration here, let's say your tax planning department have produced a .NET object that does all of your tax calculations for you.
Okay.
Maybe it's contacting back-end systems, maybe it's not, maybe it's it could do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can then embed that .NET component inside your spreadsheet, literally have a cell inside your spreadsheet which contains a .NET object, and then
really?
Access that .NET object from other cells. You can also use the features of the Python programming language, so if you've got a list of data, then one cell can hold that list, and you can look into that list from other cells as well.
And doing like web parsing or XML stuff, just to get the latest data or numbers or mm-hmm. from a stock service or something.
Exactly, yeah. Internally inside Resolver Systems, like many companies, when you install the software on your machine, it asks you, do you want to send us anonymous usage tracking data?
Mm.
And that gets written up to a file on one of our web servers. And internally, we have a Resolver 1 spreadsheet, which when you start it up, it downloads all of the data for the usage tracking for the last 20 days and shows you a nice pretty graph showing, this many people are using it, this many new users, that kind of thing.
So let's talk about some of that stuff, because that's a really interesting way. for seeing how people are using your product, what features they are or are not using. What things have you learned that were sort of unexpected from real use? We're going to design something, and then we see real user behavior, and it's either different or unexpected.
It's interesting, actually. The usage tracking data we've got back automatically has been considerably less valuable than the usage tracking data we've got by literally just emailing people and saying, hey, what problems have you had? What are you using it for?
Oh, interesting.
And that's and we've got a lot of very interesting feedback from people, largely on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
Things about the kind of libraries they want to integrate with it, the kind of industries that people are in. We were expecting lots of finance users. We got lots of finance users.
Sure.
But we were surprised by the biotech guys.
Oh, interesting.
Lots of people came in, and they want to use a spreadsheet-like interface to number crunch data from biological experiments.
Awesome.
That's great. You know, if people are going to use it to find new medicines and cure people, that gives us a nice warm feeling that you don't get from somebody trading derivatives that little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, exactly. I made half pennies on millions of dollars. Some of the other stuff you mentioned, .NET objects in cells.
Yeah.
So that certainly is a benefit to the power user, but what about security? And this is obviously something that, historically, people have always turned off macros, and you'll get warnings of macros if there's unsigned content and some of those issues. So what's the approach to security from directly within the spreadsheet? Somebody mails me one, I double-click. What's the thinking there for the end-user experience, and then how do you sort of protect... Yeah. The user.
It's not just security that's a big deal in that case, actually. It's also deployment hassles. So let's talk about that too. The same solution answers both, I think. And that is, if somebody emails you a spreadsheet that relies on a .NET component, then it's a problem if you don't have that .NET component available on your system. And so then they send you two files, and then there's another .NET component. You've got 15 DLLs and a resolved spreadsheet being emailed to you. It's a big problem. So you have deployment hassles. And as you say, that's also a security thing because they don't know that you're not sending them a Trojan embedded in one of those DLLs.
Sure.
We think that the right solution to that is to not email the spreadsheet around so much, and instead use, we've written a tool called the Resolver One web server.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's kind of like SharePoint. You know, the difference is not big. It's just a much smaller scale tool.
Okay.
SharePoint is a large application. It's meant to be run by
general purpose versus just specialized task.
Exactly. So the Resolve One web server is something you just run, on somebody's workstation almost, or something at a much lower level, and it just broadcasts your spreadsheet as a regular HTML page, and then people can view it on their computer, on their cell phone, on their BlackBerry.
Now, since I'm viewing on a browser, and we're talking Iron Python. Is there a way that you all will be able to use some of the features coming in the dynamic language runtime, DLR, and Silverlight to actually enable those scenarios where I could see a much more richer for the website, richer than HTML, but probably lighter than a full spreadsheet browser-based service using Silverlight that still would have that Iron Python code, because at the end of the day, if it's all Iron Python, you could do it all in Silverlight.
It's certainly possible. We haven't. So we've looked at that. We've experimented, but we haven't actually written anything in that direction so far. Our aim so far has been able to produce something that everyone can use on the BlackBerry use case was the important one for us to start off with.
Mm-hmm.
But Silverlight does look very cool. There certainly are possibilities there. Splitting the recalculation effort between client and server. There's cool work to be done there. We just haven't started that particular work yet.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Cool stuff. So you got some more stuff to show us? You talked about of the services?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take a look at some .NET objects in the grid.
Yeah.
So this will take a moment to start up. What I'm going to do is just load a spreadsheet, which is equivalent to what I just showed you there. So I'll switch here to some C# code. So here I have a C# program, which is basically a tax calculation library for some imaginary tax calculations.
Okay.
It's basically creating an object where you tell it what kind of product you're working with and what the price is, and it calculates various different taxes, including an R in the month tax just here. So what we can do is just compile this. This is a .NET object, which you can imagine the tax specialist in the company might have produced.
Right, so there's nothing special about it, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. It's just regular C#. So I'll just build that. That's completed the build very quickly. And what I'll do is now copy it from this deployment directory just here and paste it into the same directory as the file I just loaded. Okay, there was one there already, but I'll just copy it anyway. So,
okay, so now we've deployed and we have this .NET class that we can now use in the spreadsheet?
Exactly. So if I go down to the spreadsheet, and I will maximize that so that we've got a bit more space on the screen.
Okay.
I can type in a little bit of IronPython code down here.
You guys working on IntelliSense too here?
We will be here. So, I want to import from TaxCalc. I want to import my tax breakdown. We're also working on a GUI for that bit as well.
TaxCalc is the DLL, and I guess add reference it knows because of the specific folder you put it in. And now when you say I'm importing that, mm-hmm. what exactly is that doing?
In Python, you have to specifically, if you're writing precise Python code, you specify which objects you're importing from a particular namespace, from a particular assembly.
Okay.
So in this case, I'm saying that I want to import the tax breakdown object from the tax calc assembly. What I can do now is just create an instance of that in the grid using regular formula syntax. So I'll just do a tax breakdown. Now, Python doesn't require new or anything like that. You just say the name of the object in a bracket.
Okay.
And I'll say paper. Ooh. And that price. So I've entered literally a formula.
So now that DLL is effectively the same thing as a spreadsheet function.
Yeah, the class is inside the...
Or at least the way the user is going to use it in the spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. He's just typing the name and passing in parameters.
That's right. And by doing that, it's created a tax breakdown object. Now, the two-string method on my tax breakdown object is kind of basic. It just says tax breakdown object. That's not too useful. But we can start introspecting into that using the full features of the Python language.
Okay.
So I can ask it, what kind of properties do you have? What properties are available on the tax breakdown objects? It's going to give me a lot of them because it's a .NET object and it supports all kinds of stuff. So in this cell here, in A14 I put a tax breakdown object. In A15 I put a list. So I put a list inside an object inside a cell and a list inside of the cell. And this is a list of strings, each of which is one of the properties available on the tax breakdown object.
Okay.
Now I'll just use another bit of Python syntax here. So far I've done stuff that isn't too different from what you could put into the, say, the Excel formula language.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm going to write some real Python and say a list comprehension. So that's literally something that's looking at an existing list and filtering out stuff. So I'm going to call attra for attra in A15 if attra dot ends with tax or attra dot ends with levy. So now we've got a subset of the data from that particular list.
Awesome.
So you can see that we've got the object, we've got a list of all of the attributes it has. Let's just try taking a look inside the object and say that one dot the first in the list, office.
So one quick question, the dot ends with, is that using link? Are you using link for those things? Because I saw some or statements. Is that link specific or is that Python specific?
That's Python specific.
Okay.
The list comprehension syntax in Python is, it's been around for a while. And when I first saw link, I thought, wow, they're bringing list comprehensions to C#. Obviously, it's much more powerful and more interesting than that now.
Sure. Okay.
But it's got more than a passing similarity. So in this cell down here, I've literally just referenced into that object. So I've said A14 dot office supplies levy.
Oh, that's awesome.
So now I'm looking at the values inside the object.
Let me just zoom in to actually show that. Okay. So, and I'm effectively calling properties methods. First that method to get all the items from the call, then to filter based those results, and then to actually call. I guess that's a property, the number there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the exactly. It's one particular property of the tax breakdown object.
Awesome.
So now you can see that you could quite easily build a grid across here. I mean, I'll do something real quick now. So I'll just say tax breakdown for the first cell here on paper, that net price. I'll then reference into that. So that dot R in the month tax. I'm not entirely serious with our tax planning in this demonstration. And I'll just paste that down there, and there we go. We've got the R in the month tax for all of those products. And we can equally easily extract any other tax value here. That one dot value added tax, for example. So we're manipulating a .NET object inside the grid.
And using regular data to do it as well in a sort of natural function-like way.
Exactly. We're playing with .NET objects in a way that a spreadsheet user would find comfortable and natural.
Awesome. Okay. So some of the challenges you've run into. IronPython's obviously relatively new, and you guys are already building products on it. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges that you've run into in development?
That's an interesting question. It's surprising how few we've actually encountered. We started when we started building Resolver 1, we were intending to build a Python scripting language into a C# application.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing that using the extreme programming paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at IronPython, and it looked really pretty cool, pretty easy to use. And so we decided to do a 2-week experiment and to try building our application itself inside IronPython. So not just embedding it, but literally writing our tool inside IronPython. We did that as a 2-week experiment, intending to rewrite the whole thing in C# after those 2 weeks. 2 weeks became 2 months, and 2 months became 2 years.
And you fell in love.
I love it, exactly. It's a great language. I mean, especially if you're doing test-first development, which extreme programming requires.
Sure.
And that's I think, pretty important, because when you switch from using a typed language, a statically typed language, to a dynamic language, you obviously lose the compile time testing, or rather the compile time checking of the types.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a vital part of the testing of your program. Now, if you've got all of these tests that you've written because you're doing test-first development, then you've got tests that are just as good as those static types, as those static type checks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay to use a dynamic language if you're writing your tests first. I'd be a lot more cautious about it if I was doing, you know, regular development without a huge battery of unit tests.
Excellent. So when you say you're doing XP program, are you actually doing, say, pair programming, or
yep.
are you? Is the there
whole thing?
Whole thing. Okay.
So it's pair programming. It's working entirely to user stories and 2-week iterations with tests,
sprints, and
everything.
Scrum.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure whether our practice counts as Scrum. It's all of the terms to me seem a bit too foggy. But
okay.
But yeah, we've got a 2-week iteration cycle. So that's the sprint terminology.
Sure.
We've got full tests. Nobody owns any part of the code base. We've actually instituted a rule where although one person owns a particular user story, a particular feature, really from beginning to end, different people pair with them each day. We've actually written a little Resolver spreadsheet so that it doesn't turn into a popularity contest as someone's working with you.
Oh, nice. So you're dog fooding, I can see.
We're dog fooding a lot, yeah.
Excellent. So, great. So what is the story for Resolver 1? Is this available? Can people download it?
Where do they
go for more information? How much does it cost?
Okay, so Resolver 1, we've got one primary version. It's called Resolver 1 Standard Edition. It is available on our website. For non-commercial use, it is free. For commercial use, it is $199, currently with a limited time discount to $99.
Excellent.
The non-commercial version is exactly the same as the commercial version, except that it requires you to click on a button saying which open source license you want to apply to your spreadsheet when you hit save.
Oh, interesting.
That's there.
And the website is resolver.com?
www.resolversystems.com.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.